Hi, everyone. So first of all, let me thank the organizers for inviting me to give a talk that's probably, well, let me just say, now for something completely different. So my second apology, my first apology, was swiftly followed by my second, is that in an effort to make myself as useful as possible, I spent a fair amount of time talking to a group about some of these subjects, the background, and so my slides might get a little bit sketchy toward the end, but hopefully I can jump to the board if necessary. So the issue here is one of seeking useful tools in unusual places, and we've seen this work very well before in certain areas, which I don't have time to review, but I will attempt to just remind you, or at least set the stage. And in some ways, we can cast a lot of this in terms of a geometrization of quantum mechanical problems. Probably the most famous example of this is the ADS-CFT correspondence. It's an example of a wider class of things called gauge gravity dualities or things like that, arising out of studies in string theory that go back to the 1990s. A famous example would be to take some sort of quantum field theory. I'm hoping one of these is a pointer. No? The other one. Ah, right. How does it, is it that way? Ah, thank you. Yes, and so you have something like a d-dimensional quantum field theory, which might be an SUN gauge theory, for example. It has some coupling, I'll call G squared, and some, well, the rank of the gauge group in this sense is a good measure of the available degrees of freedom in the theory. They go like N squared in that example. That's going to be important in a moment, so I'll expand in a moment what I mean by that. But the key thing is that in a certain limit, one of the discoveries was that it makes sense to reorganize the degrees of freedom, or in some sense, the degrees of freedom told us that they want to reorganize themselves in such a way that calculating useful things about the properties of that gauge theory amount to calculating in some d plus one dimensional theory of gravity with a negative cosmological constant. And I'm going to use this little letter L, essentially a cosmological constant has dimensions of 1 over length squared, and I'm going to pull out that length squared and use that from time to time for extra clarity. So this is sort of my cartoon of that, where I have some space-time. The outer border is really at infinity, but I've drawn it so the slides are finite size, so I had to compromise. And I've cut a hole in it so you can see the interior. That's often referred to as the bulk. The whole theory is gravitational. When I study gravity in this theory, in this setting, it ends up being, once you use the dictionary correctly, it ends up being telling you about the physics of that gauge theory. What is necessary is that n must be large in order to calculate nicely, nicely smoothly curved, or gently curved, space-times in the gravity theory require you to work at large n. That's a calculational limitation, but it's where we have most control. So you're doing large n gauge theory. There's a large number of degrees of freedom floating around. Another apology I should make is that I have I'll try and remember to mention the names of some of the key people, but it's a huge field, so I haven't put names on slides. But if you want references and things like that, if you're learning about this, I'm very happy to recommend some material afterwards. So the very important result that came of this was that there are a number of very important kinds of things in the physics that one has access to in a geometrical way. For example, the thermal physics can be described, a large sector of it can be described in terms of there being a black hole in the gravity theory. So I've put the black hole in there. That black hole comes with some radius, which I've denoted RH, and you can compute the mass of the black hole, and that turns out to be the energy, the surface gravity of the black hole turns out to be the temperature, and the horizon area divided by 4 turns out to be the entropy. These of course have a longer history than things to do with string theory. Much of this goes back to the 70s and the 80s, and these systems all go together and form the cornerstone of what is known as black hole thermodynamics. There's the first law, the entropy tells you about the second law, and so on and so forth. An important thing from our perspective is that you can gather these things all together, use the dictionary that translates the length scale of ADS and the gravitational coupling in ADS, use the dictionary that tells you what those things are in terms of gauge theory quantities, and you will get the Stefan Boltzmann law. I'm actually working with a 2 plus 1 dimensional version of that. You get the Stefan Boltzmann law, and indeed exposing that the degrees of freedom are large, some power of n. If it were the gauge theory in 4 dimensions, this would have been n squared. For this example, it's a cousin of an SUN gauge theory. So anyway, so that's how that works. So I will not be talking about this today, but it's an important reminder. Another example, much more recent. This is now in the 2000s, which is the revolution in our understanding of how to compute quantum entanglement in these series. And so you have the usual setup where you have a density matrix. You trace out you have a region A. You trace out the complementary region, degrees of freedom B, form the reduced density matrix, form the von Neumann entanglement entropy, and that's a thing you can define, but it's extremely hard to compute in a lot of field theories. When you have this sort of holographic, as this is called, duality, it turns out that, again, that becomes a geometrical sort of operation. There's the region A, which I realized is, unfortunately, I'm using the same letter for area, so not the same A. There's the region A. You ask, what is the minimal surface in the full theory that connects to that region in that way? Well, you find that minimal surface, you solve the gravitational equations of motion, you find the area of that minimal surface, divide it by 4, and yes, it is not accidental that A over 4 also appears in the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, but I don't have time to explain why. And you find that it indeed computes the entanglement for you. So there's a huge amount of work done in that area, extremely useful insights gained from various kinds of theories for which we can write these kinds of duals. Then you can study things like the evolution of entanglement, thermalization, lots of very interesting issues that I know some of you are very interested in. So again, really great set of techniques I don't have time to talk about, so not today for this either. I want to talk about something very different. What I want to talk about are engines. I want to talk about real heat engines that actually do mechanical work, and of course, many of you are very interested in this sort of thing as well. In fact, there have been a number of talks at this conference about that. But of course, we're not talking about the sort of engines that are hanging around in our everyday life. We're talking about very small engines. This very interesting and beautiful dialogue between thermodynamics that we normally think of as the domain of very macroscopic things, the thermodynamics of quantum systems. So I've tried to indicate that with this very small system. Same flows, some heat flowing in, some heat flowing out, some work done. Efficiency, of course, then being 1 minus QC over QH. And what people actually study and build in laboratories, as you know, because you've heard talks about it, are actual systems that are as simple as a simple two-level system, picking out two levels in a quantum harmonic oscillator or some spin system, and actually taking that through a series of thermodynamic cycles and learning very interesting things. What I want to do today is ask whether or not there could be some use for some of the technology I described for you on the previous slides in this context. So the important thing I'd like to point to is that the working substance has, in some sense, a very small number of degrees of freedom. So can gravity and black holes help is the question. And so when we first look at, if you first look at the things I just showed you and what has gone so far, it would seem that we don't have some of the key features. First of all, we don't have any pressure or volume in the thermodynamics rules that I showed you. Those are not present in traditional thermodynamics of black holes, so we don't have the scope for doing any mechanical work. Moreover, it's way too big a system. In some ways, that large N limit makes it very classical in the sense that although it's really a quantum field theory, I have this infinite number of degrees of freedom because I'm forced to be in this large N limit where I'm trying to do this good geometry description. So this seems to be a problem, but hopefully you'll agree with me in a few slides that we can turn that frown into a smile. And the solution is that we're in the wrong thermodynamics. Context is everything. So we're going to tell you about black hole thermodynamics, which has been extended. And this came on the market a number of years ago, I think around 2009. And one of the things that struck me when I saw it in the literature was that it seemed to me to be an answer waiting for the right question. And so one of the questions here is whether one of the questions could be the quantum heat engine story. So I told you about the dictionary before. The mass was the internal energy, the area was the entropy, and the surface gravity was the temperature. What actually happens? And again, I should be giving references. This is Castor et al. They noticed that in fact, you can enlarge the thermodynamics by asking that the cosmological constant, which we know from undergraduate general relativity, is in just the right place to be a pressure. You actually ask that that be a dynamical pressure in the full thermodynamics, recast the whole story in that light, and one of the first things you find is that the mass is no longer the internal energy. It is joined by P times V, and I'll tell you what those are in a moment. It becomes, if you were a chemist, you would recognize that as the enthalpy, a very important variable to keep track of in that context. The area remains the entropy, and the surface gravity remains the temperature. But then, as I said, the cosmological constant of the theory, which we do have, and it has the right sign, it's negative, so minus the cosmological constant will give us a nice, sensible pressure that we can deal with. And then the volume, by virtue of the fact that the first law is now can be written in this way, you see that the volume really arises naturally as the fixed entropy partial derivative of H with respect to P. And in fact, the temperature is its counterpart in that way. Just for fun, I'm going to get myself in trouble. Why don't we do an example together and see how this works, because this is very unusual for a number of people. And one of the things that you'll learn in this way is that whatever else this is good for, it's an extremely useful way of developing new thermodynamic systems to torture undergraduates when you're looking for new thermodynamic problems, as you'll see. Essentially, the black hole metric itself, which you can write down as a solution of Einstein's equations, supplies the equation of state in the following way. So this is the geometry of the solution. There's some function there, which for Schwarzschild looks like this. And the horizon turns out to be the largest root of where that thing vanishes, as you might recall. That, in some sense, tells you an equation for, given a horizon radius, it tells you what M is. That's going to tell you what the enthalpy of the system is. So you can essentially call this the enthalpy. The entropy, in the usual way, is a quarter of the area. And there's a standard calculation for computing the surface gravity to give you the temperature. So this would be the traditional way you would do black hole thermodynamics. Now, remembering that the entropy can be written in terms of powers of R, I could actually put this in here to write what will be the enthalpy in terms of the entropy. And L tells me about the pressure, so I can write the enthalpy in terms of its natural variables. H is written there now in terms of S and P. So I can perform the derivatives. Let's just check that we get back the right temperature, so I can I do it all for you, and off you go. If you convert it back into the original variables, you see this is the temperature that we derived through surface gravity. So yay, that works. Off we go to something new now. What would the thermodynamic volume B, and I start with H again. Now I differentiate with respect to pressure holding the entropy fixed, and a few lines of algebra tell me that it's in some sense the obvious thing. But that's surprising. If you work on black holes and you work on general relativity, that's both interesting and horrifying for various reasons, because we really shouldn't think of the black hole as a ball of radius r inside. But if you think of it in terms of, you know, what's the difference between the space-time with and without the black hole, this certainly is not an unreasonable quantity. So that's the naive volume becoming the thermodynamic volume. One thing I'll say, and it's going to be very important for us, is that that is not always the case. In fact, we will find that it will be necessarily the case that we do not have the naive geometric volume in what we, for what we need. There's a little bit about, okay, why enthalpy? I think I'm going to jump to this. Let's talk about that other problem. So now we have work, because we have P and V, so we can do PdV and integrate. What about the degrees of freedom? That was another big problem. Well, let's actually check. Let's be careful about what we mean when we're asking what the degrees of freedom are. What we really should do is use a probe that tells us what the degrees of freedom that come into play are. And of course, many of you will know that a nice probe of that is the specific heat, right? It's telling me that I put some energy into the system via heat, and you know, via this term, and I'm trying to raise the temperature of the system, trying to raise the internal energy of the system, and if there are degrees of freedom that can store that energy, they'll turn on, they'll contribute to that function C of T. If there are not such degrees of freedom, they will stop. They will not contribute, and C of T will have no support from those degrees of freedom. I know you know this very well, but it's going to be extremely important for what I'm about to say. Now, C of V, the specific heat at constant volume, is in some sense the sharper tool, because specific heat at constant pressure actually includes energy that may be given up to changing the volume of the system. So let's actually focus on this quantity for what we're about to look at. So for black holes, the usual C, the usual entropy, that's there, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. You can work out what it is as a function of temperature, and that's great, but actually that was at some fixed cosmological constant, so that turns out to be Cp. So the question is, what is Cv? And the interesting thing I noticed a couple of months ago was that that's largely overlooked. People note when it's zero or non-zero in this extended thermodynamics, but they have not actually explored its temperature dependence, and that's exactly what we need to do here. And the interesting thing is our favorite black holes, Schwarzschild, Risen-Oschram, other static black holes, pure gravity solutions, actually have Cv equals zero in extended thermodynamics. Now, given what and that follows from the fact that actually the volume is just the naive geometrical volume, the thermodynamic volume is the geometrical volume, and S is the area. So there's only one parameter that they both depend on. If I know one, I know the other. So if I keep volume fixed, I can't have any non-trivial derivatives of the entropy, so Cv is zero. So that sort of means there's no degrees of freedom. And so, yes, that's horrifying, because many of you know that we use these black holes all over the place, and they seem to have n to some power degrees of freedom. But the point is, it's context. In this extended thermodynamics, those degrees of freedom, when you try to excite them, they also result in volume changes. So they belong to Cp, not Cv. So in this extended framework, there are no degrees of freedom for our usual black holes. So all those n, large n degrees of freedom I talked about, they're not the traditional ones that we think of as getting access to in some everyday thermodynamic system of our favorite thing in the lab. So what to do? Well, there are black holes with Cv not equal zero. An example is the Kerr black hole. If I take the black hole and spin it, and I know you're going to object, because now everyone knows what a black hole looks like, and that's certainly not it, but it's a cartoon. you can actually compute the volume, and it looks something like this. There's a much more complicated dependence on the various things. This was done some time ago by Brian Dolan, And you actually end up writing it. It's actually hard to write these things in closed form, but in this case, you can write it, and you can write it in terms of h, and if you send j to 0, you'll get the formula I described before. When j is non-zero, v is is completely independent of s, so I have a non-trivial CP. What people have not done, and there are many other examples I'll tell you about. Another one which actually is very important, if you don't like spinning black holes, if you don't like Kerr, you can have a certain family of charged black holes, not Reisner-Nordström, but in fact some cousins of Reisner-Nordström. They're called STU black holes. It turns out that these can be constructed by considering four separate U1s with four different charges. When they're all equal, you essentially have the diagonal combination that gives you the Reisner-Nordström solution. But if you change these in a way that, as you'll see in a moment, to my mind, is somewhat suggestive of doping the system in an interesting way, you'll then get a non-trivial CV. You'll get non-trivial degrees of freedom appearing in the count. So those are the two sets of black holes that I studied. In both cases, unfortunately, they're extremely hard to work with analytically, especially for investigating CV versus T. So I get to pretend to be an experimentalist and plot dots, like many of you have been doing. But let me first tell you a little bit about the overall phase structure of these black holes should remind you of the van der Waals equation of state in some ways. These are some isotherms I've plotted. And what there actually is indeed, there's a critical point. And below there, there's a series of first order phase transitions. All the things you know about van der Waals apply here. And it's all very interesting, and that's not really what I want to get at, except that I want to tell you that some of the features that we're going to see can be found well above the critical point. So we're safe from any sort of complicated phase structure that you might think would destroy the story. So let me tell you what those features are. Well, one thing you can do, and this is well known, our familiar friend CP, you can actually go and work out its functional dependence as a function of t, and indeed in the neighborhood of the critical point you get the classic, and it turns out to be in the van der Waals universality class, you get the classic divergence. And look, there are my data points and everything. So you extract this by setting up the equations of motion setting up the whole system implicitly defined on a computer, and then using combinations of MAPLE and MATLAB to essentially data mine the equation of state numerically. Now here's the really interesting new stuff. This is CV as a function of T. So what I've done is I've shown you examples at particular volume slices. So take run at fixed volume, run along these curves, and what you're seeing is that indeed, well, what happens is that at large temperature, at high temperature, CV actually goes to zero. But at intermediate temperatures, it actually comes in and peaks. When last seen, the peak was going into that region. So one could follow it there, but for simplicity, I'll stay out of that region. But the point is there's a clear peak. Now, those of you who think about condensed matter systems a lot know exactly what these are best called. They're Schottky peaks. And they're telling us something very interesting about the degrees of freedom in the system. These are Schottky-like peaks. And they're telling us that there's a finite window of energies available. There are degrees of freedom, but in some sense, it's a very reduced set of degrees of freedom. And there's a finite window. The Schottky peaks, for those of you who don't know, come in many systems. You have an additional sector, you maybe have some hyperfine splitting, or maybe you have some defects. And then those degrees of freedom contribute to CV at some temperature, temperatures around the scale at which their energies exist. But then as CV goes higher, they can no longer contribute because it's beyond energies where those can contribute. There are no more degrees of freedom at higher energies, and so CV falls to zero. So what we found in this black hole system in extended thermodynamics is that one has a controllable set of degrees of freedom that I can actually control the position of, and either the charge or the spin is a parameter I can dial, and I can dial it so that I have just a small number of degrees of freedom, which is exactly what we need to study our quantum heat engines. So we've turned our frown into a smile. We now have pressure and volume, so we can actually do mechanical work. We have the thermodynamics that the black hole system naturally comes with because of quantum mechanics in the neighborhood of black holes. And we have, in some sense, a small system which will play the role of our quantum harmonic oscillator or some other small device that you might build in the lab. So this is the proposal then, holographic heat engines engineered in this way can perhaps provide models of quantum heat engines. I can build an Otto cycle, and this is crucial, and this all started because I was trying to figure out how to make an Otto cycle out of black holes, which hadn't been done before. Now you can make an Otto cycle because I can do these moves, which are adiabats, where entropy is kept fixed, but still change the volume because CV is non-zero. And so I can do what you've seen in experiments now. I can have some heat flow in, some heat flow out, and go in a cycle that way. And so this diagram is a placeholder for both kinds of system. Either this is a quantum harmonic oscillator, and I'm doing a tour in the space of harmonic oscillators in the sense that I'm changing the coupling. Volume here turns out to be inverse frequency, and I go from there to there, then I couple to an external bath, lose some heat, go back up, get some heat, and so on and so forth. And I do exactly the same thing now, but with the black hole story. This is a holographic heat engine in the sense that every point is holographically dual to a quantum field theory in the sense that I told you at the beginning, but now I can actually do an adiabatic expansion coupled to a heat bath, excite those degrees of freedom, those small degrees of freedom that we saw due to the Schottky peaks, couple those to some external heat bath and flow some of their energy out, and then go back and close the loop. It's a space, it's a tour in the space of quantum field theories now. So completely analogous structures. I think I should stop at this point. There's a lot to be said. I actually did spend a fair amount of time testing out the robustness of this, computing some efficiencies, and seeing that the system makes sense. You have to do all of this numerically, but it is extremely well controlled. It would be nice if there were some black hole models where one could write down CV exactly, but I don't know if that's possible, but that would be an interesting thing. But anyway, here are some discussion points, and I offer this to you as an arena where maybe some of us who are doing some of this out there stuff could actually be useful for something for once. So the question is, are these solvable models? The key point is that the equations of state are given to you by the Einstein equations. You, in principle, have those. If not in closed form, you can have them to any desired accuracy. You can interrogate the system, all of the thermodynamics, to your heart's desire. So this may be a good arena in which to ask questions that are difficult to ask either of the experimental system or of the theoretical models of this done in more traditional ways. So I'm curious to know what issues in experiment and theory these might be able to help with. I've read things about questions about studying power versus efficiency, the trade-off between those two, issues of what you can do by enhancing the system by running the system near criticality. I know that people are very interested in that business of going off the perfect Otto model. Can we model friction and noise in the system in this way? What about modeling how it connects to the heat bath? It would be very interesting to see whether one has access to that in this gravitational context. And then the other question I have is whether the quantum heat engine community, do they do other cycles besides Otto? Because those are really easy to do using these methods. So I'll stop there.
Talk and questions.
Thank you for the very, very interesting talk. I have a lot of questions, but I'll limit myself to two. One is, it's a very nice result that you can formulate a heat engine in this context. Do you expect that this quantum engine offers any quantum advantages over our favorite auto cycle in our cars?
That's an interesting question. So where I've explored right now is sort of in the safe region where I think the thermodynamics and the governing laws of thermodynamics, in particular the second law, certainly controlled by the self-consistency of the Einstein equations itself. So I'm not going to see any surprising, you know, the efficiency is greater than Carnot or anything like that. The second law is still very firmly in place. I know that in the literature there are reports on, and I don't know how robust those are because I was reading some rather old papers, there are reports on perhaps when you get to the quantum regime, quantum fluctuations allow you at least sort of to temporarily appear to fluctuate to higher efficiencies in that way. So it'd be interesting to know whether one could get to analogous regimes in the gravity context. I do not know. So violations of second law aside, then there's the issue of whether one could just get better models of substances that allow for better approach to Carnot. And there's an interesting other family of papers I read about using the fact that you may have a critical point in order to help enhance the specific heats near a critical point and thus get better heat flow. And so that's something which would be interesting to explore. I wrote an example of my first attempt in this field was a couple of years ago where I actually designed a realization of that. Now I realize I was using the wrong kind of heat engine. So I have reinvestigated that, but I think I need a critical point in CV, not CP, which I don't have in these systems. So the answer is, I think there's a lot of opportunity to explore several of these issues. Now we have an arena, assuming it's relevant. Was that one question or two? That was seven answers, though.
That was great, thank you. The other question was, would you explain the musical reference on your slide?
Oh, it's particularly appropriate here, actually. When I was a postdoc here in the early 90s, I decided to take up the trumpet because I realized that you can play the trumpet without disturbing your neighbors if you just wander down to the beach. So as a postdoc here, I'd arrive early in the morning, put my stuff in the office up there, and then I'd wander down to Goleta Beach, back before most of it was eroded, on the other side of that cliff, and I would teach myself to play the trumpet back then, and I became rather obsessed with the trumpet and started putting it on my slides and everywhere. This is a remnant of that.
Thank you.
A question here. So usually we think of the cosmological constant as a parameter in the theory in ADS-CFT, and not something that was associated to a state. So when in your heat engine, you want to change the pressure, which is the cosmological constant. How can you say something more about how you imagine doing that in a concrete scenario, in a concrete theory?
So two things. So I indeed have left off the issue of whether or not, of how one goes about engineering the dynamical cosmological constant, but one can generally have in mind a couple to some additional sector whose dynamics you've turned on to allow it to supply the cosmological constant. And in ADS-CFT, we do know of such an example, and that's essentially all the scalars in the gauge supergravity. Right, when we're at the standard ADS point, we're just at the critical point of those scalars. Those scalars have dynamics. You can turn on those dynamics. Those scalars move off their critical values to some other value and change the cosmological constant. This is holographic RG flow. So we know this is something that is already built into the technology of ADS-CFT. We just don't use it as much as perhaps has been relevant for this, largely because people tend to do those holographic RG flows at zero temperature, and we'd need them at finite temperature here. But even outside the ADS-CFT context, one can imagine that story where one just has some additional sector that plays the role of cosmological constant. The ADS-CFT correspondence is just sort of the starting point in some sense. Yes.
Can you
I thank you. Yeah.
So many thanks for this beautiful talk. A couple of questions. One is still about the sign of the cosmological constant this time, because if you had a positive one, right, then we would have a negative pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So how, in this case, I mean, you could still build your quantum heat engine, and how could that work? Second question is whether all this and how, in case, would depend on different kind of space-time. So if you could differentiate between different space-times looking at your quantum engine.
So, let's see. Yes. One can do the extended thermodynamics, and many authors have written several papers showing what all the structures are analogously. They don't really say much about what to do with negative pressure. I don't have anything particularly profound to say. You can do it or not do it. And so this is the context in which I think I can at least make sense of things. I suspect, in fact, I have a conjecture that I should probably keep to myself for now, because it's either completely nonsense or... There's a couple of examples in that context that I think will have relevance to heat engines, but one has to be extremely careful about how one deals with the pressure, and I'm not fully satisfied I know how to do that yet. So I'm simply going to say I don't know the answer. I think there's something to explore. The second question I've already forgotten.
If you can differentiate between different space-times, looking at how your quantum
engine... So what am I not allowed to see? So am I only looking at, for example, the specific heats or what have you? So you know, it's a very coarse-grained tool. I'm not sure what to say. The different kinds of spacetimes will give you different things. So, for example, the two sets of examples I gave, I had Kerr and I had these STU black holes. And when I work out where the Schottky-like peaks are and everything like that, the patterns are subtly different in different cases. So each case has their own character, although they do share some features. I'm sure there's a whole industry of other kinds of black hole solutions for which you could compute the Schottky peaks, and if they are there, and see what they might be used for. I don't have anything intelligent to say, except that I'm sure people will do that. Sure. Yes.
So this is suggestive of running the sort of D-brain decoupling argument for ADS CFT, not with a fixed number of D-brains, but a fixed chemical potential for the Ramone-Ramone charge. Have you thought about sort of running that argument in that context and asked what the sort of correct formulation and rules are for ADS CFT in this different ensemble?
Yes, so I should say I have, and several other authors have as well, including I think among the earliest would probably be Brian Dolan. He and myself and a number of others tried to lift the extended thermodynamics to the full 10-dimensional sense, count the powers of n, and then try and introduce chemical potential. I ended up not writing anything beyond my original remarks because it just the powers of n just looked messy to me, and I'm not saying anything's wrong. It just wasn't compelling that it was helpful to do that, to lift everything. So I think there's more to be done.
A closely related question is also suggests that you could do this more generally, thinking about an ensemble of quantum field theories with a chemical potential for a number of colors and so forth. So I'd wonder if you tried to construct heat engines and so forth in that more general context.
Yes, so I think that's the right context. And there's a very nice paper also, a lot that needs to be thought about alongside that, which is by Andreas Karsch, and I've forgotten his co-author. But you have to remember, so, you know, P is L, L contains N, So yes, chemical potential for allowing that to vary, but also remember that there's an L setting the volume that the field theory is on, which is not the thermodynamic volume that I've been looking at here. So one also has to take that into account. That's an important subtlety he pointed out. So, but never, but the general idea, I think, is certainly a useful one. But no one, I think, has sort of compellingly written something down other than the authors I mentioned. Yes.
Can I?
Oh, sorry, Sean, yes. Yeah.
A couple, so let's see. So one funny thing about this volume, of, as you know, is that so it's not extensive, so these degrees of freedom are not extensive in this volume, right? So this thermodynamic, like the entropy, is not, doesn't double if you double the volume, right? In these equations of state that you have. I mean, clearly, because, you know, one goes like RH squared, the other one went like RH cubed.
So oh, I see,
so,
right.
So,
oh,
clearly,
good.
The you know, if you double the entropy, you won't double the volume. Sorry, if you double the volume. So that is will have some unusual features, probably, compared to normal thermodynamic systems, I guess, right?
Yes. Yes. Well, in addition to the unusual ones we've already seen because of the way CP and CV organize themselves, but carry on.
Well, it may not be unrelated. So maybe related. So when you introduce the spin or the charge, there of course the first law now has more terms depending which ensemble you're in.
Yes.
There are extra chemical potentials for rotation.
Yes. So I worked in the ensemble in which they're fixed. So those terms are off.
Right, because if you worked in the one where the charges were fixed, you would get zero again for the specific heat, I think, probably,
yes.
Right? Is it right?
Yeah, yeah. So, I worked a lot of that out back in 1998, yes.
Now, also, does the second law definitely hold in this? So in the original second law that, you know, Hawking proved, and it was from Einstein's equations, but of course, in Einstein's equations, you don't vary the quadratical constant. So if I start varying the quadratical constant, that's outside of Einstein's. If I allow myself to do that however I want, it's not obvious that the second law is going to hold, right?
It's not obvious that you're outside that framework, but I've seen no evidence that the second law should fail.
I just mean that...
carry on.
No, like a time-dependent quadratical constant is outside of Einstein's equations, right? Because clearly, let's say we don't add a scalar, we're just allowing ourselves to change the chemical... constant, however we like.
Fine, but I'm saying let's not forget that we would have some sector that is gravitating, and so it's Einstein. You know, so there's some T mu nu, which is the stress tensor of that stuff as well.
Like this PDV, like the DV and the P is not constrained there. So it's just not totally obvious that the second law might hold.
Great. I have not seen. Okay, so there are a couple of places where I've thought about the second law and what it means in this context for things to do with gauge theories. And so, for example, in a paper I wrote last year with Philippe Rousseau, we actually showed by working with hyperbolic black holes and issues to do with RG flows of entanglement that the second law of thermodynamics in fact maps to Zamolodikov's C theorem in arbitrary dimensions in a way that I found quite satisfying. But that may be circumstantial evidence. Moreover, every heat engine I've ever built, the Carnot efficiency is always the highest I can do. So I'll take that in the spirit of our 19th century colleagues, I'll take that as evidence that there's some law. You're right, though. It's possible. I don't think anyone has explicitly redone the area non-decreasing theorems while that's varying. Or maybe it's implicit in the paper of Castor et al. I haven't thought about that. That's a nice thought. Thank you.
Okay. I'm afraid we have to interrupt the discussion here, but we can start again after the lunch break at 2. Right, so we meet again at 2. And let's thank both the speakers again.